You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Chaos Theory by Natalie Koretch. In October 2017, Jackson, whose last name was then Sunderland, he took his husband's last name after getting married, was outed by BuzzFeed for being part of a long-running email chain created to mock the early stages of the woke movement on the Internet. The group included far-right activist Milo Yiannopoulos, once a Breitbart editor. "Please mock this fat feminist," one unearthed email read from Jackson to Yiannopoulos in reference to a Times columnist. "I drove traffic, whether that was me with my boss's permission, sending opposition media our story so they'd make fun of them, or I had a good instinct for what would sell," Jackson says. The day after the BuzzFeed story was published, Vice fired Jackson. "That era when he left Vice was such a different time culturally," says independent journalist Taylor Lorenz, who has known Jackson since his time at Vice and covers many of his current clients. "I actually think if that scandal had happened now, I don't think he would have lost his job or been pushed out. Conservative media would rally around something like that." While the emails ultimately cost Jackson his job, he saw a cultural shift in the works. "There was a mind virus in 2017 where everyone thought the world was going," Jackson says, using a catchphrase beloved by the likes of Elon Musk. "Anyone who has read American history or American pop culture history would have known that woke was never going to last forever." He argues that while it was partially a gut instinct to lean into his cancellation and away from woke trends, it is also the cycle of American pop culture dating back to P.T. Barnum. "Controversy and irreverence have always been what works," Jackson says. "Some people have accused me of being part of the degradation of Western culture or whatever, which I take as a compliment," Jackson says, of his second career in communications. "I'm not a Svengali. I'm not a puppet master. I'm just practical in responding to what works. It's like, okay, I got canceled. I need to work. Practical." Jackson's business is referral only, and he has amassed an impressive client list, which he in part attributes to his ability to maintain long-standing relationships. Jackson first met Calloway a decade ago after assigning a story about her Instagram presence. The two kept in touch until Jackson was fired from Vice, and he says Calloway stopped speaking to him. She later apologized, and they made amends, he says, with Jackson advising Calloway on the release of her self-published book, Scammer. Years earlier, Calloway had been reeling from the fallout of backing out of her book deal, a former friend taking credit for editing her Instagram captions and co-writing her book proposal, and hosting a series of live events that drew comparisons to Fyre Festival. "I did push Caroline," he says, "to publish her book at the same time as one by Natalie Beach, who claimed to be Calloway's ghostwriter." Calloway tells me that while Jackson did suggest the timeline, it didn't change her plans whatsoever, considering there was no world in which I would have let her book come out before mine, so we were already on the same page before he said anything. Mitchell made a brief cameo in Lily Annalick's 2023 profile of Calloway for Vanity Fair. "For this story, I ask Calloway about her relationship with Jackson, which," she says, "after being friends for a decade, there is no one whose perspective on media I value more." Jackson says it's definitely a collaboration, adding that Calloway is good at handling press on her own as well. "She would have been a good publicist, honestly. I think Candace would be a great publicist also, he added. Owens, Jackson says, has a very clear vision when it comes to content. She follows her interest. Every day it's a surprise what the show is going to be. That's the fun of it, he says. What people don't understand about Candace is that her audience is millennial moms. She has taken the place in the culture, like her show comes out at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard, which is the same time Ricky Lake and Oprah used to be on, Jackson continues. She is daytime television for millennial moms. Jackson touted the recent coverage of Owens, including an appearance on Theo Von's podcast and coverage in the Wall Street Journal, for being the number three podcast in downloads and views across platforms earlier this year, according to Podscribe. Those, to me, are wins, he says. There's people who look down on me or look down on this, but they write about it every day. Owen's success, of course, has come with its fair share of controversy, such as her 2024 suspension from YouTube after sharing an interview with Kanye West that included anti-Semitic content. More recently, in July, French President Emmanuel Macron and his wife Brigitte Macron filed a lawsuit against Owens for defamation over her conspiratorial claims about the couple, including that the First Lady of France was born a biological male. Editor's note: there is absolutely no reason to think Brigitte Macron is anyone other than who she says she is. In a statement, a spokesperson for Owens accused Brigitte Macron of trying to bully a reporter into submission and said she will not be shutting up. And Jackson responded to the suit. Today, we have the legal court and the court of public opinion. I live to defend the First Amendment for independent creators. The Macron story is now a free speech story. Jackson's guiding philosophy is that divisiveness is key, which Owens shares. Some people have to love you, but some people have to hate you, he argues. The secret to longevity in the spotlight is leaning into the controversy. The people who hate her and send out clips every week to the 10 same Twitter accounts are really helpful for promoting the show, Jackson quips. I don't want them to stop. Given clients like Owens and Cooper, you might infer something about Jackson's politics. Though he says he's voted for Democrats and Republicans, I'm an independent, he says. I think Trump is a con man. I grew up in Florida, so I have a pretty good understanding of a con man when I see one. There's so many things about Trump that are actually the worst parts of Democrats. Not paying their bills on time, that's a Democrat. I don't think he won because of racism. He won for the same reason Zoran Mamdani won, which is that a lot of people are struggling to get by. I've never identified with either party, he adds. I deal with both enough to know that they're both bullshit. I know how the sausage gets made. The thing about Mitchell is he recognizes that it's all a game, Lorenz says. He is able to position his clients and work with the press effectively because he understands their goals. Given his brush with cancellation, he's not a Pollyanna, and he recognizes the bad faith stuff, but he also knows the value of attention and how to manipulate attention online, adds Lorenz, who has seen her share of online drama. It's really valuable because comms people, a lot of them, don't understand the way the internet is and how to leverage negative attention for subscribers. The ability to harness negative attention for a positive outcome was preached to Jackson from an early age throughout his turbulent childhood, he explains to me casually over lunch. His parents' pet store just outside Miami was regularly protested by animal advocacy groups, which his mother leaned into. It was actually going to go out of business, and the protest resurrected it because she turned it into a circus, Jackson recalls. She had counter-protesters. As a child, Jackson says, he saw the long game in gaining and maintaining attention. His mother used to say, "You'll never starve in America if you're shameless. Only prideful people starve," he adds, which sounds quite a bit like the motivating factor of his clientele. Meanwhile, Jackson's childhood allowed him to learn how to thrive under chaotic circumstances. I actually feel more stressed when things are calm, he says. That also makes me give much more rational advice to my clients because I'm not operating out of a place of panic. This is a crucial skill for crisis management, which he provides to many clients, considering himself somewhat of a Rick Rubin of controversy or a Yoda of scandal. Sometimes what should be a routine PR job for Jackson devolves into a crisis situation. One such situation was when he was put on retainer to help Maya Henry, Liam Payne's ex-fiancée, with promotion for her book. In early October 2024, Henry accused Payne of One Direction fame of obsessive behavior, and so when Jackson got a call from TMZ that month, he assumed it was related to a crime. Then they were like, no, we need help identifying a body, which turned out to be Payne. TMZ was one of the first to report Payne's death at 31 after he fell from a hotel balcony in Argentina. The outlet immediately drew outrage and ethical questions after publishing and then deleting photos showing portions of Payne's body while reporting on the incident. In that circumstance, anything Henry said was going to be taken out of context right away, Jackson argues. The fans are the fans. His role in managing that crisis mostly included batting down reporters and eventually providing a statement to a prominent outlet, in this case Rolling Stone, to try to change the narrative. When reflecting on the crisis, Jackson says it was the hardest thing he's dealt with throughout his career, given Henry and Payne's complicated relationship. Even considering the hard work that goes into managing crises for high-profile clients, Jackson torches the celebrity PR firms that are risk-averse and decide to drop clients who enter a crisis situation, calling the move unethical. He argues that you shouldn't consider yourself a publicist if you can't handle a crisis. Celebrities spend a significant amount of money on their PR team, and the second they have a scandal, get out of town, he continues, I think that's really effed up. Meanwhile, he argues that publicists at large firms are obsessed with control rather than their clients' best interest, adding that they fail to realize how the PR machine was changing around them. You have more control when you surrender control, he says, of the current media ecosystem. You're going to control some fashion magazine five people read. You can't control TikTok. You can't control House and Habit, Jackson says, referring to Instagrammer and Substacker Jessica Reed Krause. In a PR situation, you get the card you're dealt, and you have to play that card. You can't try to play a different card. Otherwise, you're just going to lose, Jackson says. One example he used to explain the concept was Amber Heard, who failed to reshape the narrative into one casting her as a victim of Johnny Depp. In a defamation lawsuit, Depp was able to turn the public opinion against his ex-wife Heard, winning more than $10 million in damages over an opinion essay she published in the Washington Post in 2018. Depp, through his attorney, was found to have defamed Heard in one of three counts in her countersuit. She should have made fun of herself, Jackson argues. She should have covered herself in chocolate on Saturday Night Live. Everyone would have laughed. Everyone would have forgiven her. Making fun of yourself is very powerful. Heard would be a dream client for Jackson, and he'd also love to rep JoJo Siwa, Madonna, the Metropolitan Opera, and the State of Israel. I think I could do wonders for Israel if they would listen, Jackson says, adding that he thinks the country has the biggest PR problem of the moment. Still, Jackson will draw a line, saying he wouldn't work with provocative Free Press founder Barry Weiss. I'm in the relationship-building business, he says, not the bridge-burning business. This is the October 2025 cover story, Sibling Rivalry. Elle and Dakota Fanning have been acting almost as long as they've been sisters and have hit remarkably few bumps on the road to grown-up movie stardom. Their secret is simple. Savannah Walsh reports, a familial bond, even a notoriously tough business, can't break. With photographs by Ines Envenoud. Sister act, Dakota Fanning and Elle Fanning, photographed in Los Angeles on July 22nd. Growing up, when Dakota and Elle Fanning played make-believe, both of them knew who was in charge. I was the top dog no matter what, says Dakota. She was the groom, I was the bride. I was Anna Wintour, and she was the assistant. One of their favorite games was inspired by the TLC reality series, A Baby Story. Dakota was the mother, and Elle was her newborn. The younger Fanning would dive beneath a beanbag while her sister laid on top of it, mimicking labor. Eventually, Elle would emerge, wailing like an infant as Dakota bellowed, "Oh, my baby!" That's like Nathan Fielder, Elle says now, shaking her head. But she can't be too embarrassed. That was the most fun I've ever had in my life. Any pair of siblings could devise their own A Baby Story game, but most kids don't have access to prop medical equipment they received snagging a guest spot on ER. Every older sister busts her younger sister for stealing her clothes, but usually not after being tipped off by paparazzi photos. Now 31 and 27, the Fannings have been famous nearly all their lives. Both started acting as children. Both had their first kisses on camera. Yet on screen and in conversation, the sisters somehow radiate normalcy. Why aren't they more effed up, says Elle, finishing the question. She leans back in her chair, taking a drag from an imaginary cigarette. We're like, we're so effed up, you don't even know the half, she laughs. But seriously, even though we were young in this business, I don't feel like I missed out on anything. People want us to feel like we missed out. They love that narrative. The Fannings have always written their own story. They've worked with many of cinema's great auteurs, Tarantino, Spielberg, and Coppola, both Francis Ford and Sofia. They've received Emmy nominations for splashy streaming projects. And yes, they've sidestepped the traps that snare many young actors forced to grow up too fast. Perhaps most remarkably, they've also avoided the pitfalls that plagued some of Hollywood's most famous and famously feuding sisters, Joan Fontaine and Olivia de Havilland, Joan and Jackie Collins. When I asked Dakota if she and Elle ever feel competitive, something in her posture tells me she saw this question coming. But her answer is firm. Zero. We obviously share a lot, including a stylist and a publicist, but we're very different. So I don't even see something that's right for her as being right for me. I don't feel competitive, but I know that people probably don't believe that. They'll buy it more once Elle and Dakota finally make a movie together. After a packed fall, during which Dakota works opposite Sarah Snook in the Peacock limited series All Her Fault, while Elle appears in Joaquin Trier's Sentimental Value and the sci-fi blockbuster Predator Badlands, they will produce and star in The Nightingale, their very first time on screen as co-stars. When we were younger, we wanted to make sure that people saw us differently, and we wanted to give each other space to carve our own path, says Elle. But as adults, it's been very fulfilling to merge. Hannah Dakota and Mary Elle Fanning were born on opposite ends of the millennial Gen Z divide in 1994 and 1998. The sisters spent their early childhood in Conyers, Georgia, and genetics suggested they'd have promising athletic careers. Their father, Stephen, played minor league ball. Their mother, Joy, was a college tennis player and daughter of a former quarterback for the Philadelphia Eagles. Neither one took to sports. instead embracing an equally cutthroat path, though you wouldn't know it from Little Elle's first experience on a movie set. She made her big screen debut in 2001 at the age of 2 as the younger version of Dakota's character in I Am Sam. Elle was just toddling around the set, this little towhead, not a care in the world. Michelle Pfeiffer, who also starred in the film, remembers. Their personalities were kind of set in that Elle is a little more free-spirited and Dakota slightly more serious. Those archetypes seemed to guide their early work. Dakota played children in peril opposite towering leading men like Denzel Washington in Man on Fire and Tom Cruise in War of the Worlds. Elle's whimsical nature led to fantasy projects like David Fincher's reverse aging romance, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, and Disney's Maleficent, as the ethereal Princess Aurora to Angelina Jolie's Dark Fairy. These days, the sisters appear more alike. "Did we wear the same outfit? It happens all the time," asks Elle, as she plops down at a table in the center of Chateau Marmont's lush garden. "It's true. When I speak with each Fanning individually, they're both fresh-faced and nail polish free in a crisp button-down paired with neutral slacks. Both are dressed head to toe in the row, founded, of course, by another set of sisters, save for Elle's dainty lowy bag and goop trousers. The differences are there for those who pay attention. Elle's lacy white bralette is slightly visible. Dakota's shirt is buttoned nearly to the top. Elle shifts from one subject to another with breathless abandon. "We'll get into all of it," she promises, dipping a chip into our guacamole, then apologizing for any chomping that my recording device may detect. Dakota, who wants to talk on a partially obscured sofa in the corner of the chateau's lobby, is more reserved. "We should talk about that tomorrow," she suggests at one point, gently but firmly steering me away from topics she'd rather cover with Elle by her side. Their demeanors shift when they're together. Dakota laughs more freely, tilting her head back with joy as they trade childhood memories. Around her older sister, Elle's a little more demure. A few weeks after our first interviews, I'm Zooming with the sisters to ask a couple follow-up questions. Elle is talking about the time she wore a red Fenty dress to a Rihanna concert. "I swear that she saw me and..." "Oh, please," Dakota interrupts. "Savannah, you'll have to do a follow-up interview with Rihanna to confirm that," she cracks, an eye roll evident in her voice. In our first conversation, Elle makes a point of saying that she took her career cues from Dakota. At one time, her sister would have agreed. "She wants to go everywhere I am," a tiny Dakota says of an even tinier Elle in an aughts-era featurette about the English-dubbed version of Hayao Miyazaki's My Neighbor Totoro. "She's a lot like me. Her favorite color's pink. She wears her hair in pigtails, and she loves to be with me. Even now," says Elle, "I just want to do everything that she does." Some celebrities resist acknowledging their familial advantages, but Elle wears hers proudly. "I'm a Nepo sister. Of course I got opportunities because people are like, oh, it's Dakota Fanning's sister. We'll see her audition." As an adult, Dakota's sheepish about how she used to order Elle around. Over Zoom, she brings up a video Elle posted in 2019 of the sisters getting ready for a long-ago Halloween event. Little Elle wants to hang. Little Dakota shoos her away, shouting, "Go get your wig back on." "I'm being so bossy," Dakota says now, and Elle's so sad and cute, just wanting to hang out. Even then, the differences between them could be stark. "You're so tiny," she's talking to her sister, "but I felt older inside." She trails off. "You're judging your small self," Elle tells her softly. "You only wish you weren't so mean." "Her attitude," says Dakota during our solo interview, "has changed as I've gotten older. I just want her to have everything that she wants. What's mine is hers, and I feel the same thing back from her. We have that mentality in our family. When something good happens, it's shared by all of us because we've all helped each other get to where we are. Kirsten Dunst, whose bond with the Fannings runs so deep that she jokingly refers to herself as the third sister, says this solid foundation has paid off. They're so smart, smarter than I was at this age, but also they're real. They understand the bullshit of this industry. Pfeiffer, who also worked with Elle in the Maleficent sequel, agrees. I've never felt there was anything I could teach these two ever, she says. They're a lot younger than me, but they feel like peers. Elle has another theory for why she's emerged into adult stardom relatively unscathed. Dakota was always there to protect me, she says, her clear blue eyes getting misty. It's molded both of us, the responsibility that she's felt, that I don't even know that she's felt. I don't need to look at the menu, says Elle, as she enters Casa Vega, a nearly 70-year-old Mexican restaurant in the San Fernando Valley, owned by longtime Fanning family friend Christy Vega. Dakota drove them both there in her navy blue Porsche Macan. Elle also has a driver's license, but her primary set of wheels is a limited-edition Kate Spade bike with strawberries on the seat. As we settle into a red leather booth, Dakota sits directly in front of a gold plaque that reads Dakota Fanning. She's also got a namesake margarita on the menu, a huge flex for Valley girls, she says. Elle and I both order the Dakota. Yaya Reposado Cointreau, house-made honey thyme elixir and fresh lemon juice, topped with an orange salt rim. The actual Dakota gets a beef taco, no lettuce or tomato, almost exactly what she requested at the same restaurant when she was 12, promoting the live-action Charlotte's Web in the pages of Vanity Fair. The Fannings have formed a production company called Llewellyn Pictures, an ode to their first and only childhood dog. In meetings, they each take on a familiar role. Dakota is more practical, translating Elle's wild ideas into actionable items. But Elle may be pickier. Dakota takes pride in marrying high and lowbrow culture. Put caviar on a McDonald's chicken nugget, and it's the greatest thing ever, she says. But the sisters are completely aligned on their first film as full-fledged co-stars. The Nightingale, based on Kristen Hannah's best-selling novel about French sisters in Nazi-occupied France. We've literally never done a scene together, ever, Dakota says. As Elle wonders if she'll be able to get through their first take without breaking, am I going to laugh? Better to get it out of your system now. They'll produce the project alongside actor-turned-mega-producer Reese Witherspoon. The film has been on hold for years. Dakota and Elle were about to head to Budapest for pre-production as the pandemic hit. When it was resurrected, filmmaker Michael Morris, fresh off the fourth Bridget Jones movie, stepped in to replace their original director, French actor Melanie Laurent. He has daughters and really seemed to understand the dynamic, says Dakota. Hollywood has long been angling to get the Fanning sisters in the same movie, and not as different versions of the same character. They were in talks to co-lead My Sister's Keeper, a 2009 tearjerker about a young girl conceived to become a marrow donor for her gravely ill sister, but stepped away from it because Dakota didn't want to shave her head. Sofia Vasileva and Abigail Breslin ended up in the movie. Plus, says Dakota, she and Elle acting together at that age would have been gimmicky. The Fannings waited this long, they say, because they needed a project that would give them equally compelling arcs. The Nightingale follows guarded older sibling Vianne, who urges caution when dealing with the Germans, but later hides Jewish children in her home, and rebellious younger sister Isabel, who joins the French resistance and becomes a target of the Nazis. What I love about it is it's two women fighting, resisting, says Elle, one in a louder way, one in a quiet way. Along with the Nightingale, The Fannings are working on a Hulu true crime docuseries out in September. But the number one question they get, according to Elle, is when they'll make a TV series adaptation of Paris Hilton's memoir, the rights to which A24 acquired on their behalf in 2023. They'd welcome the opportunity to weave that outward persona, the glitz, the glam, the chihuahuas in clothes, with the darker underbellies of Paris's journey, says Dakota. She confirms they've met with the former socialite at her home to discuss a TV project, a childhood dream come true. Hilton met Dakota while filming a cameo for The Cat in the Hat back in 2003. Watching her and Elle grow into such talented, grounded, and inspiring women has been a full circle moment, Hilton writes by email. The Fannings also paid attention to the heiress's trajectory, making them the ideal fit to adapt her memoir. They grew up watching my career unfold, so they understand both the cultural impact and the personal journey behind it, says Hilton. They see beyond the catchphrases and sparkle. While Hilton remains mum on which Fanning will play the Nikki to her Paris, she notes that Elle and Dakota are uniquely qualified to tell their story. Growing up in the public eye, especially in the middle of peak tabloid culture, was intense in ways you can't really explain to someone who hasn't lived it, says Hilton. Though Elle and Dakota were largely spared by the tabloids that documented Paris's and Nikki's every move, they're no strangers to the media culture of the 2000s. Your biggest concern was being the worst dressed in the back of Us magazine, Dakota says. We'd always get them at the airport or in the nail salon. I'm 9, flipping pages like, is my outfit on there? It was not, most of the time. Things only intensified as they got older, though Elle says Dakota had it harder. Someone was always trying to catch her doing something, she falters, trying to remember the name of a long-dead website before it comes to her. Ocean Up. It was like a Perez Hilton for young, like Disney stars. Dakota groans, Ocean Up was brutal. Eventually, I told friends of mine, just don't put any photos on the internet. I have no photos from that time. She had more than one reason to lay low. I definitely had my guard up. It wasn't even really about this will ruin my career. I don't want to get in trouble with my mom, she laughs. It wasn't about the public. It was Joy Fanning. Elle was a little more inclined to test the waters. Or perhaps, she muses, she just got caught more. Elle and Dakota remain very close with their mother and grandmother, who live together and recently accompanied the sisters on a rare vacation to Hawaii. But it's not clear how their father fits into the equation. Joy and Stephen separated in 2016. I don't think we should go there, Dakota says with a nervous laugh when I bring up the subject. It is a longer story that I just don't think we feel comfortable to share. Elle agrees. Then perhaps, eager to cut one of the few moments of tension during our time together, she adds, it's an ocean up. Dakota is fine answering questions about her child star days, really. Maybe there were moments where I was annoyed by it, she says, sampling an iced tea back at the Chateau Marmont. But I would never have shown that to anyone. She sheds a flip-flop, tucking her bare foot behind her other calf, a blue Hermes bag at her side. I've always compared it to a great uncle at the family reunion, being like, I remember when you were this big. It was that all the time. Dakota's breakthrough role in I Am Sam at age 6 earned her a Screen Actors Guild nomination and a Critics' Choice Award. Orlando Bloom hoisted her up to the microphone to deliver an acceptance speech. When I started, my mom was my age now, says Dakota, and raising a movie star means confronting some unusual questions. What does one say to Tom Cruise when he asks if your daughter can accompany him on a helicopter ride? How should you dress her for an interview with Jay Leno? The answers, as Joy learned, are, I guess, and apparently a pair of opaque tights with Mary Jane's. Joy was the anti-momager, says Dakota. She was relying on finding good, trustworthy people. She went with us everywhere, but also gave me a lot of space to find my footing. From I Am Sam on, Dakota made about 2 films a year on average, until she graduated from high school in 2011. In some ways, it's about what you don't do, says Pfeiffer. They've both been incredibly selective. Dakota went away to school at the peak of her career. Like, who does that? Dakota had some growing pains during this time, particularly related to being apart from her mother. She celebrated her last day in California at Disneyland with friends, then felt terribly guilty she wasn't spending those precious hours with her family. Dakota will also always feel a little responsible for her younger sister. It makes her uncomfortable when she feels that I'm out of control, she says. But I've been responsible and in control of a lot of things for my whole life. Sometimes you have to get me home. If, for instance, Dakota's had one too many Dakotas, she's super supportive, but likes it when I'm together. Dakota considers that before leaning in and lowering her voice, I'm always in control deep down. A few times during our conversation, Dakota mentions big emotions, annoyance over being labeled a child star, anxiety in the early weeks of living in New York, and her desire for nobody to know she's having them. My mom told me I would not practice tying my shoes in front of her because I didn't want her to see that I didn't know how, she says. She was like, I couldn't teach you if you wouldn't let me, so you didn't know how to tie your shoes for a long time. Dakota repeats what has become something of a personal mantra. I'm not going to let people see me sweat, and you're not going to get one over on me. With a steely look in her eyes, I'm inclined to believe it. Living in New York was a long-time dream for Dakota. That is what cool older people did. I wanted a loft with brick. A luxury condo building with neighbors like John Meyer and Tyra Banks isn't too shabby either. She studied film and women's studies at New York University's Gallatin School of Individualized Study, a program designed for people who, say, have to shoot the TNT drama The Alienist in Budapest between term papers. The Olsen twins went there, too. But Dakota left New York before she could collect her diploma. Her trusted advisor, Rahul Hamid, died in 2022. He would be disappointed that I haven't done the last thing to graduate, she says, looking down and searching for her next words. But I think he would understand I don't want to do it without him. Dakota often thought of Hamid while making a largely improvised romantic drama with mumblecore filmmaker Joe Swanberg. Hamid introduced her to Swanberg's work. Every once in a while, you need an experience like that, Dakota says. It revives something in you. Since leaving school, Dakota has turned frequently to prestige TV. I've not had the experience of doing 6 seasons of something, she says, but doing a limited series kind of feels like a movie. Her upcoming slate no longer includes Rodham, a serialized adaptation of Curtis Sittenfeld's novel that imagines Hillary Clinton's life had she never married Bill. I would be totally open if it came together again, but at the moment, no. The press has been hailing Dakota's first adult role for some 15 years now, from her edgy turn as Cherie Curry, lead singer of a 70s teen punk band, in The Runaways, all the way up to Ripley, a 2024 8-episode adaptation of Patricia Highsmith's novel. But her next project marks her first time playing a mother. She can't personally relate to the haunting premise of All Her Fault. A mom realizes her son is missing after a playdate gone sideways, but she knows she'll have kids of her own someday. I have wanted to be a mother since I can remember, she says. I will do that no matter what. When Elle floats into the chateau for our solo afternoon chat, a pressing question arises. Are you the older or younger sister, she wants to know. Older by 3 years. So you relate to Dakota. Eager to establish there are no favorites here, I say I am actually closer in age to her. Oh, so you're close to me, she replies. Satisfied with the answer, we order matching iced oat milk lattes. Elle feels like the younger sibling to me, says Dunst. She presents herself more unencumbered by things, but I think that's deceiving. All three of us wear things pretty lightly when we present ourselves to the world. But there's a depth. They're very discerning, very intuitive. Nothing gets past those two. The younger Fanning is used to being underestimated, much like Catherine the Great, whom she played for 3 seasons on Hulu's The Great. That's the character most like me, she says. People on the outside see her as young, romantic, kind of girlish. But there's so much more on the inside. Elle has always beat her own drum, particularly when it comes to fashion. When her classmates wore tight Hervé Léger glass dresses to bar mitzvahs, I was in crazy Rodarte pants that people didn't understand, says Elle. But I was like, I get it. Her singular taste led Elle to producing and starring as disgraced Gleek Michelle Carter. In the limited series, The Girl from Plainville, making her Broadway debut opposite Sarah Paulson in Appropriate, and returning to film with last year's A Complete Unknown as the soulful girlfriend of Timothée Chalamet's enigmatic Bob Dylan, her first movie since 2020. You almost feel you're reintroducing yourself to the world, Elle says, folding her black straw into smaller sections. I was in Timmy's trailer like, I'm nervous. He's like, I'm nervous. Oh yeah, you're playing Bob Dylan. She's more comfortable at the Chateau Marmont, the Hollywood institution where she shot Somewhere, her first movie with Sofia Coppola. Elle was 11 at the time, drawing raves for her performance as the daughter of Stephen Dorff's aimless film star. Her latest movie is also about fathers who make films. In sentimental value, Norwegian filmmaker Joachim Trier's searing follow-up to The Worst Person in the World, Elle plays an American actor drawn into family drama when Stellan Skarsgård's Gustav cast her to play his daughter in a movie, the role his actual daughter, Nora, Renate Rense, refuses to take. Elle didn't want her character, Rachel, to be the cliché, bratty, snotty kind of Hollywood star. I wanted to make her curious and brave. The part wasn't a giant leap for her. I've had movies that didn't work out the way you wanted to, but you always realize why you did them. She balanced duties on that project with her role in Predator Badlands, the next chapter in the franchise from director Dan Trachtenberg. The script had so much heart, which is wild for a Predator film, says Elle. And she couldn't pass up the chance to play mysterious dual roles. I did get to live out the parent trap fantasy of acting with yourself. Next year brings Margot's Got Money Troubles, starring Elle as a cash-strapped young mother who starts in OnlyFans. She raises her eyebrow, as we have all thought about. Then comes The Hunger Games, Sunrise on the Reaping, in which Elle takes over the role of Effie Trinket from Elizabeth Banks. Effie's the best character, but I do feel pressure. That's like playing Bob Dylan. Would she ever make her own film? I can direct Dakota, Elle says, thinking back to her days as second banana in the playroom. Finally, comeuppance. Before we leave the chateau, I mentioned Dakota's theory that Elle is unnerved when her older sister asks for help. She enjoys getting a rise out of me, says Elle, though she admits the first time that she called me for advice, it was like the sun had just come down on me. Now we talk about everything. She knows all my secrets and I know all of hers. I relish the fact that I can protect her because she needs protection too. Underneath that tough exterior, she has a very delicate heart. Back at Casa Vega, Dakota urges her little sister to scoot forward so she can spoon some esquites onto her waiting plate. Then the real dishing can begin. For 2 years, Elle has been dating Rolling Stone executive chairman Gus Winter, and she doesn't care who knows it. If your partner doesn't post you on Instagram, that's a red flag. I love my boyfriend, and we're going to post each other, she told me the day prior. I'm so happy, and Dakota loves him. That's the seal of approval. Elle was in Paris when her sister and her boyfriend first met, accidentally bumping into each other in Las Vegas. We were newly dating, and I really cared about him, Elle says. They were at the same after party. She turned around, and there he was. Then they had this whole night of gambling. Dakota was with all of her girlfriends, and I'm getting sent videos. She's dancing with Gus. Dakota was happy to bond with Winter, but I used some stern words. Just warnings, cautions, said with a smile. It went great. He's the brother I never had. Elle aims similar protective energy at any man in Dakota's life. I actually screamed at someone for her. I didn't throw a drink, but I did knock it over and accidentally spilled on the guy, she says. Dakota is currently single. I've had some doozies lately, but one day, Elle chimes in with a huff, these guys, what is wrong with them? How dare they? I ask if either of them has dabbled in the invite-only dating app Raya. They exchange a look. She has never done this, ever, says Elle. And then the other day, I did it for fun, Dakota interjects. My girlfriend made it for me. I was like, if I don't, then I'm going to think, maybe my husband is there, Elle finishes for her. I can confirm that he is not, says Dakota. Elle urges Dakota to show us her Raya anyway. I haven't seen a ton of familiar faces yet, Dakota says, scrolling through a few suitors. Elle notes correctly that they all look exactly the same. Then Dakota reveals why she really made her profile. Guess what my song is? You already told me, says Elle. It's Salt Shaker, the biggest hit from early aughts hip-hop group the Ying Yang Twins. Dakota sighs, I'm canceling this thing. Long after our Dakotas have been emptied, I ask the Fannings what this moment means to them. For Elle, it brings to mind a Donna Lewis song released in the four-year gap between their births. I love you always forever, near and far, closer together. Everywhere I will be with you, everything I will do for you. When I hear that song, I always think of us, says Elle, her voice breaking. Dakota reaches an arm across the table. Elle starts to cry, then laughs. I'm on my period, she says, sending us all into hysterics. And we talked about when I first got my period yesterday, too. She was 14 and first felt the cramps at a Chanel fashion show in Paris. Not relatable, she said then with a laugh and a shrug. Perhaps to make her little sister feel less alone, Dakota launches into her own story. This wasn't my first period, but it was early days. Dakota was attending the 2009 NAACP Awards with her castmates from The Secret Life of Bees. I was in a nude chiffon kind of baby doll dress that I think was BCBG. We got home and Mom goes, what is on? Oh, Dakota. It's covered. Now, I've never seen any photographs. Ocean up, Elle and I say in unison. Then it's Dakota's turn to get mushy. Because of Elle, I'm able to have confidence and security in my life, she says. If I lost every friend I have on the planet, the extremes, Elle shouts, dabbing her eyes with a cloth napkin. I'm just saying, Dakota continues, if everyone in my life stopped talking to me, I'd be devastated. But if I still had my sister, I'd be like, well, I have her. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.